British Public Radio. Nature.
This week, the future of science publishing. No more Nature papers?
We'll have algorithmic filters that listen to all of the interactions that all of the scholars in the world are having with all of the products in the world and use those to assess relevance.
And back to the publishing present, getting at the structure of proteins without freezing them in place.
I think this could be, to use an overused word, transformational.
Plus how carbon dioxide escapes from the deep ocean. I'm Kerry Smith. First this week, we're taking a look at the future of scientific publishing. So long, dusty, leather-bound journals on shelves of rich mahogany. Goodbye, PDF printouts. Noah Baker has been finding out how your scientific life might be different in a decade's time.
March 28th, 2023, somewhere near the University of North Carolina. Jason Priem rolls out of bed, the coffee brews. Then he checks his email.
In my email, I get sort of a list of, the five things that I ought to read right away.
So far, so similar. The top five science papers of the day before, then?
Mostly no. Instead, we'll be leveraging the ability of the web to actually observe scholarship as it happens. What I mean by that is we'll be looking at data sets, software, daily lab reports, really the day-to-day business of scholarship, all sort of knit together and made into a story, a narrative that we can understand by blog posts or something that looks quite like a blog post.
Which sounds like a lot of information, all before the first sip of coffee. So how are the top five chosen? By whom?
That list of five things is curated somehow, and the curation is actually coming from my network. It's aggregated from all of the things that my network has done over the last 24 hours. The things they've read, the things they've talked about and discussed online, the things they've blogged about, the things they've cited, the things they've explicitly recommended to me. We have the ability on the web to actually pick up on all of these traces that once were invisible, and we can use those traces to then create this very tightly curated stream for me to consume.
In a comment piece this week, Priem argues that this is the future of science publishing. So-called paper-native journals are coming to the end of their life. The whole process of publishing science is in for a serious revamp when faced with the power of the web. It's not just your email alerts that will change, he says. First under fire is how we assess the validity of the science being published. Peer review.
In the paper-native world, we've essentially nominated a few experts who said, you know, y'all really know your discipline, so we're going to make you an editor, and you can select some peer reviewers who you believe really know the discipline as well. So we nominate these people to select on our behalf. In the web-native world, we'll have algorithmic filters that listen to all of the interactions that all of the scholars in the world are having with all of the products in the world and use those to assess relevance.
Experts from around the world openly reviewing each other's work on the web. Sounds great, but will scientists actually be willing to take part? Trials have shown virtually no scientists will openly criticize their colleagues' work. Instead, peer review is anonymous. How does Priem suggest we'll get there from here?
We can't simply cast these sorts of new systems ex nihilo and drop them in and assume that people are going to use them. They have to be gradually built into the reward structure. And I think the 10-year horizon is quite realistic. I think the transition will look like sort of a first phase wherein more and more scientists move on to social networks. We're not going to see saying, dear, you know, Dr. Scholar, please write this peer review where you put yourself out to professional risk and get no apparent professional reward. Instead, we're just going to see people mining the networks that are increasingly going to become fundamental to the scholarly conversation. Once we've done that, I think the second phase is for us to start blurring the lines between a peer review and a scholarly product.
And so, instead of reviewing others' work directly, scientists simply publish opposing views and critiques as research in its own right. Their validity is determined after they are published. But in this system, is there any external quality control? Science must be clear, accurate, and accessible. Without editors, how do we maintain these high standards?
Who do we think is more qualified to maintain quality controls on science, quality controls on the expression of science? Do we believe that it's individuals nominated by the community, or do we believe it's the aggregated judgments of the community itself? The difference between the paper-native world and the web-native world is in the web-native world, we finally have the ability to observe that process of consensus as it actually happens. We can observe it in the wild. Let's imagine that I start writing scientific articles that use flagrantly wrong terminology, ugly and obfuscating language. It is quite likely that the community will lose its respect for me. They will stop consuming my work. They'll stop saving my work in their reference managers. They'll stop discussing my work in blogs, and quickly I will fade into obscurity.
I had to ask, from the offices of Nature, what happens to journals in this future? Preem suggests they'll become recommender services, which use their knowledge to write the best algorithms to deliver the best content.
The last thing that we want is one algorithm to rule them all. Right? I think this would actually be a terrible future because this algorithm encodes all sorts of values. It says, well, you know, I think blog posts are incredibly important, whereas tweets are not very important. And so you write that into the algorithm.
So 10 years from now, Nature is a recommender service. I am writing algorithms and all of science is openly available to everyone on the web for free. I hate to rain on this parade, but who foots the bill?
I think we don't want a world in which we pay for information. This is a very sad world. It works counter to exactly what the internet continues to ask of us, which is make information freer and freer. Services, on the other hand, are quite amenable to being bought and sold. And so if we imagine a world that does have recommender services that deliver personalized recommendation to individual scholars, I think those sorts of personalized recommendation systems could very easily be sold on sort of a subscription model if they demonstrate that they're more effective at surfacing good content than traditional journals are, which I think they inevitably will be.
So how does this vision sound to you? Read more from Jason Preem at nature.com/nature. Comments welcome at the Future of Publishing special page. And be sure to make this podcast one of your 5 unmissable things per day.
Coming up, we have the research highlights featuring fatherly mice and how primate hunting shapes forest ecosystems. But first, a new twist on a tried and tested way of peering at proteins. X-ray crystallography has revealed the structure of DNA and countless other molecules, helping scientists to understand how they work. The procedure lets scientists see the shape of molecules by shining powerful X-rays at them and measuring how the beams scatter. The laborious technique has now gotten an upgrade. A Japanese team has come up with a way to make determining the shape of small molecules such as drugs simpler, quicker, and even cheaper. John Clardy, a chemist at Harvard Medical School in Boston, tells Nature reporter Ewan Calloway about the new technique and why he thinks it could transform chemistry.
The real bottleneck to crystallography is in the name. It requires a crystal. And the only successful ways we've had of using X-rays to see things are when they're held in regular arrays, the sorts of arrays that are provided by crystals. But it's very hard sometimes to get things to crystallize. So molecules, for example, can have a floppy shape, and so it's hard to get them to all line up and behave. Often you have only very limited amounts of the material, and it's very hard to crystallize small amounts.
So tell us about this new technique that you describe in your News and Views this week.
Well, it's really very clever. It reverses the normal way of doing things. Normally, you would get a molecule, and then you would try to coax it to be a crystal, which is a temperamental, kind of artisanal process. In the new technique, they already have crystals. They're crystals that they call crystalline sponges, and as the name implies, they're regular, like crystals, but they have big holes, like sponges. And what they do is they take these pre-existing crystals with these well-defined cavities, and they let them soak up molecules from solution. And the surprising thing is that the molecules go in, they're held tightly, and they're held in a very regular way that makes the subsequent X-ray experiment quite straightforward. It's basically crystal-free crystallography.
How long does this take to do? Are we talking a single day compared to weeks or months to get a molecule to crystallize naturally?
So there is no sort of simple recipe to get molecules to crystallize. And so it can range from hours to never. So it's a huge range. With this technique, it looks like it's on the order of a day or two to let everything soak in and reach equilibrium and give something that you can do the experiment on.
How does the technique perform? I understand these researchers, you know, put it to the test to determine some structures.
They did some actually really very interesting things. They came up with a blinded set of small molecules, gave it to a colleague, and the colleague did, at least in my opinion, remarkably well on using only the X-ray data to come up with the structures of the blinded set. And the most impressive is they took a naturally occurring molecule, this marine natural product, that had defied other methods to figure out exactly what it was. And it's the kind of molecule that's very important. It's naturally occurring, like a lot of biologically active molecules. It's incredibly floppy. It's just like a long piece of rope. And the mystery is in the middle, and the two sides are almost identical. And they used a very small amount of that. It went right into the crystals, and they were able to figure out what it was for the first time. So I think that's a remarkable achievement.
The molecules that this team solved with this new technique, they're all pretty small. I mean, and The molecules that a lot of people are interested in determining the shape of are bigger proteins. Does this technique have any hope of determining the structure of proteins?
I'd be reluctant to say it doesn't have any hope, but in its current form, it doesn't have any hope. It's probably limited to molecules with molecular weights of several hundred and not bigger than that. The size limit is determined by the size of the cavity in the sponge. And the cavities they have are on the order of 5 to 10 angstroms, which accommodate a lot of small molecules, like, you know, drugs and things like that. But they wouldn't accommodate probably even the smallest protein. I'm sure people are now will begin thinking along the lines of how to make bigger scaffolds that might be useful for small proteins.
So what's the big picture about this technique? What's it going to mean for, you know, scientists who would potentially use it?
So I think this could be, to use an overused word, transformational. A lot of people are foraging around in marine organisms or soil bacteria looking for new anti-cancer agents. And often one of the difficulties is figuring out what they've found from a very small amount of material with a complex structure. And a technique like this could make that research proceed much more rapidly.
That was John Clardy, and his News and Views article on the paper is at nature.com/nature, where you can also look up the original research by Fujita and colleagues. Coming up, how the ocean breathes out carbon dioxide, but now for the research highlights with Adam Rutherford.
Hunting for primates can lead to big changes in the forests they live in, changes that can make the forest no longer suitable as a primate habitat. Gorillas, chimpanzees and monkeys all eat fruit and then spread seeds by spitting and defecating. Researchers from Lund University in Sweden monitored several spots within the Nigerian forests. Sites that were protected from hunters had many more primates than hunted sites, as you might expect. They also had twice as many fruit tree seedlings. So if primates are hunted out of forests, it's a vicious circle. The seeds from the fruit trees can't spread, and the primates may not have enough fruit trees left to feed them. You can read more about the study in the Proceedings of the Royal Society. Brain damage can make a virgin male mouse behave like a father. Male mice that live with their mate help to nurture pups, whereas virgin males attack the pups of other males. Researchers at the Riken Brain Science Institute in Japan pinned this behavioural difference on the vomeronasal organ, which detects pheromones. When they surgically removed this region from the virgin males, they began to behave like mouse fathers, picking up pups and returning them to their nests. And that study is published in the Journal of Neuroscience.
Carbon dioxide comes and goes in the atmosphere. During ice ages, there's less CO2, and in warmer periods, more. We know that during cold times, CO2 is stored in the deep ocean, especially the Southern Ocean around Antarctica. But how does it escape again? Thank goodness Nele Mecca is here. You could call her a carbon dioxide detective. She's at the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology. The main idea right now is that winds change the circulation in the oceans and allow CO2 to get out. But Meckler and her team have another theory. They think that changes to the density of the oceans could change their circulation. When warm water sinks, stuff from the deep can get to the surface, including CO2. But how to prove it? Meckler and the team looked at a species of plankton called diatoms, who live near the surface and whose little shells are made of opal. To make them, they use a mineral called silica, which is usually buried deep in the ocean. Silica is Meckler's key piece of evidence because, like CO2, it's released when the ocean circulation changes. Thea Cunningham spoke to Nele Meckler, starting with that question: how does carbon dioxide escape from the deep ocean after an ice age?
So currently we think that much of the CO2 that's missing basically from the atmosphere in the ice ages is stored in the deep ocean. One idea why is that the southern ocean was more stratified and the deep ocean was more disconnected from the atmosphere, which allowed the deep ocean to store more CO2 during the ice ages. One way to reestablish the connection between the deep ocean and the atmosphere would be by, if you increase the wind or have the winds shift to a position where they cause upwelling in the southern ocean, the deep ocean got connected with the atmosphere again and CO2 was released again. And in our case, one other way to increase the communication between the deep ocean and the atmosphere is if you change the density of the deep ocean. So we put forward an alternative hypothesis, and that's a change in the density of the deep ocean, which would then trigger communication between the deep ocean and the atmosphere and release CO2.
And in the deep ocean, you looked at a type of plankton. They're known as diatoms.
Yes, so we are looking at these plankton species as an indicator for what kind of water mass was at the surface at this time. We look at the sediment core in the subtropical North Atlantic, and in this core we find these layers where we have a lot of opal all of a sudden deposited, and opal is the mineral that the diatoms make their shells off. So we know that the diatoms were much more abundant during these times, during these transitions from ice ages to warm stages. And this must mean that there was a lot of silicate abundant all of a sudden. So something must have changed in the ocean circulation that all of a sudden supplied silicate during these times when CO2 released.
So there's technically not a direct link between the diatoms and the carbon dioxide. Instead, these opal deposits are telling you that there were changes in the ocean circulation at the time. And from that, you can tell there would have been changes in carbon dioxide release at the same time.
Yes, what we stumbled across was that our observation does not fit at all to the currently favored hypothesis of how this CO2 release is taking place, right? Because the current hypothesis is that the winds caused this establishment of a connection between the deep ocean and the atmosphere. But if that was the case, this wind-driven upwelling would also cause an intermediate water mass that is very silica poor to be exported to where our site is. And so it would do the opposite of stimulating diatom productivity. And instead, the way we think the silica is supplied to the surface and is stimulating this diatom productivity is because the intermediate water circulation is basically coming to a halt during these terminations. And that allows silica from that's stored in the deep ocean to diffuse all the way up to the surface. Now, if the silica can diffuse upwards, also heat or warm water from the surface would be able to diffuse downwards. So this would then stimulate convection there and then communication between the deep ocean and the atmosphere and CO2 release.
These results essentially put ocean circulation in the steering wheel.
Yes, that's correct.
How can we use these results to help us monitor carbon dioxide release?
I don't see a direct application of our results to monitoring or regulating CO2. But on the other hand, what I think our study points to is that the changes in the ocean circulation and changes in the density of the ocean can have a large impact on ocean biogeochemistry, and that includes the uptake of CO2. So in the future changing climate, it's very likely that both the density of the ocean and the ocean circulation will change.
That was Nele Meckler on the line from Zurich. News now, and with more on the future of publishing, it's Richard van Noorden. Richard, welcome.
Hello, Kerry.
Now, you're a bit of a geek about publishing. You've been our publishing geek for this week. We've already heard from scientist Jason Priem about his sort of wide-angle view of the future. But in your news feature this week, you've been looking at something a bit more specific. That's open-access publishing.
I decided to look at a really contentious issue in publishing, which is how come all these open-access journals are produced so much more cheaply than the existing journals we have? Could it be that we could publish research articles for millions, billions fewer dollars than we do currently? Are publishers being paid too much?
Yeah, good question. Here we are sitting in the offices of Nature, wondering if we're paid too much. That hardly ever happens. You said it was a contentious issue. Was it difficult to report this?
Well, it absolutely was. And one reason why it's been very hard to look into this issue is subscription publishers gain their revenues by charging libraries, and often they sign contracts which don't have to be disclosed. Meanwhile, few publishers are public, that is, they have to publish public accounts. And even of those, you can't delve in and see what their publishing division has made. So you have to ask them, and very few said. Now, the exciting thing about open access journals is the money they charge authors for publishing is there transparently up front. So you can just look at why some journals are cheaper than others.
So what's the kind of average that a scientist would be looking at now to publish in one of the existing open access journals?
Well, the average for the whole industry, which includes mainly subscription and about 12% open access, is about $5,000 an article. If you just think about the revenues that the publishing industry takes in, almost $10 billion for almost 2 million articles in 2011. Now, there's a very wide spread, of course, between journals. So this journal, Nature, the editor-in-chief, Phil Campbell, has estimated it would cost between $30,000 and $40,000 to produce each article. That's what Nature would have to charge up front if it went immediately open access. Other journals, for example, the open access journal PLOS ONE, charges authors just $1,350. And yet other journal editors I spoke to, such as Pete Binfield at the new journal PeerJ, he says his costs are in the low hundreds of dollars per article. So there's an enormous spread around that $5,000 average, but the open access publishers tend to be on the cheaper end.
And what can be behind that range? Because that is, as you say, a massive amount of difference between a few hundred dollars and $30,000 to $40,000 at the other end.
So this is really the argument. The more expensive journals have a number of arguments to say why they're more expensive. Number one, you've got to remember that a lot of the old subscription journals still have print runs. The open access journals are necessarily online only, and they're saving a lot of money through not having to make print runs and not having to have complicated access agreements and subscription paywalls. So that automatically will take out some money, and a change of business model can account for some of the changes in costs. But the real difference and the real argument that we come to here is that the more expensive publishers say they add more value, more quality, and they are much more selective. They reject many more papers as they go through peer review, and all that extra administration adds to the cost of each accepted paper. And the question is that worth it? Is that what scientists want?
And is it practical? I mean, who's got $30,000 to $40,000 sitting in their university account ready to be spent?
Well, that indeed is why the more expensive journals are still on the subscription model. Rather than loading all the costs onto the authors, or more likely the institutions or the funders of the authors, they load the costs onto a wide number of readers. And it's perhaps the case that these very expensive journals could never go fully open access, or they may have to be cross-subsidized with a less selective open access journal. For example, we know that PLOS ONE, which published more than 23,000 articles last year, actually subsidizes other journals in the PLOS family, PLOS Medicine and PLOS Biology.
So far we've talked about mainly the production costs. What about the kind of added value, those sort of slightly soft, squishy things that an expensive journal might also add?
Well, there's two kinds of added value that we need to talk about. One is the extra added value to the article itself. So more expensive journals saying, look, we just do more typesetting, more copy editing, more graphics, and authors want that as a service. And some people might say, look, I can put up my article on archive quite cheaply and then I can peer review it. I don't need all of the extra XML, all of this extra stuff that publishers add. So that's one of the arguments. The other type of added value is, well, this podcast, for example, is funded by the money that Nature Publishing Group gets through its article publishing. And there's the journalism, and there's not just the journalism, but the news and views papers and all of that. One of the big questions on the cost of publishing is the profits, the margins that publishers make. They don't just take revenues equating exactly to what the cost of the paper is. And the average margins of the industry are 20 to 30%, which is quite high. But the real irritation is more sort of where are these margins going? And people feel the commercial publishers are perhaps repaying those margins to shareholders, whereas the society publishers are perhaps ploughing them back into science.
You're talking about the kind of commercial publishers at one end, and I imagine Nature falls within those. What's our margin?
Yeah, well, I asked Nature. They wouldn't disclose their margins. So the only margin information we have is from Elsevier, at approximately 40 to 50%, according to three analysts I talked to, or 37% in their accounts. So the typical numbers that we're talking about here. And it may be that the switch to open access, or the hope is that because scientists start to see the cost of articles up front rather than hidden away in library contracts, so to the academic, all of publishing is free. Because of that, competition, price competition, will start to bring down what journals are able to charge. That's the hope.
So to what extent then is the future an open access future?
This is really a very interesting question. At the moment, as I said, open access journals make up only about 11, 12% of all journals. So it's a minority. I think it's really going to be driven by what funders and researchers want to do. And we're talking just before on the 1st of April, the UK brings in new policies to require scientists to publish open access. It's that kind of funder mandate and enforcement, if it is rigorously enforced, that will really change the environment here.
All right. Thank you, Richard. And for more on how we'll publish science in the future, there's an entire special dedicated to this week. What else is in it? Give us a glimpse.
We've got a really interesting examination of predatory publishers, as they've been called by some people, open access journals at the really low end that essentially sucker authors into paying money for what is a very poor product. We even have a news article, in fact, about criminals who created counterfeit journals purely to sucker authors into paying money for a journal that does not exist. We have a number of voices on where the future of open access publishing is going. In particular, we have John Wilbanks looking at the fraught issue of licenses. So you can publish your paper to be open, free to read, but that does not mean that it is necessarily free to reuse, to translate, to sell again. And there's a real tension going on between scientists who say, I would like my research to be freely reusable to everyone, that's why I'm publishing it openly, and, oh, actually, I'm not sure I want it to be freely reusable by commercial entities. And Wilbanks is discussing what kind of licenses we should have for open access.
So plenty of conflicts of interest right through the special, it sounds like, and more details on all of that at the special link nature.com/scipublishing. Next time on the show, what would happen to an astronaut who fell into a black hole and other questions that keep me up at night. Plus, we've had a musical revamp, so we'll be debuting our new sound. I'm Kerry Smith. Thanks for listening.